Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, parliamentary staffer stood down over sexual assault complaint, confusion reigns over the future of Huawei phones in New Zealand, and wasp numbers are increasing dramatically in Auckland, and experts are warning the populations could climb higher if they're not controlled.
I do happen to see them everywhere, but I don't know if that's because I'm keeping my eye out, because that's what I do.
Coming up in The Week in Review. But first, a voice for the silent majority. That's how Destiny Church's Hannah Tamaki has described the new political party she will lead. Mrs. Tamaki and her husband, Bishop Brian Tamaki, together launched Coalition New Zealand on Thursday. They say the new party is a response to the harmful policies of the current government and the erosion of New Zealand values. Checkpoint's Lisa Owen was at the launch at the Executive Lounge of the Destiny Church complex in Manukau on Thursday afternoon. Lisa started by asking Hannah Tamaki what her top three policy priorities are.
Children, families, and prisoners.
So you've said
That's what I'm saying today. It could change in another month.
Could it?
Well, I might find some other passion that I think might need a little bit of push behind them.
Are you committed to those things now, though?
Absolutely.
So part of the reason that you said you're launching this party is you're concerned about the current leadership in this country. What specifically concerns you?
Well, I think a little bit of discrimination, and when you want to help your people and you're not given the opportunity to, that's disheartening.
So discrimination against who?
Let me see, somebody that I'm married to, an organisation that I absolutely love, like Man Up and Legacy. And Legacy is actually the woman version of Man Up. So I know that people sort of say, we're the woman in all of this, and we're the Europeans in this. Well, we have Europeans, and the woman version of Man Up is called Legacy.
But people listening to this might think that this is a revenge party then, if that's the reason it is now, because your husband can't get his program into prison and you feel he's been discriminated against.
No, well, I just think that we need some common sense. I think we need some nana staff, some mother staff, somewhere that the everyday New Zealander can relate to. We have a lot of politicians that, I don't know how many of them are grandparents. I haven't, looked into it. But I know that I've always had a passion for people. I've always got on well with people. Hence, for the fact that I'm not afraid to step into this realm. It's going to, like I said, I'm chartering a whole new life. But I'm prepared to do it for the people on the ground. I work and walk with the people on the ground every week. I'm not the sort of person that's distanced from people. I'm relatable to people. When people come just for counselling, I help them. And they don't necessarily have to be Christians or in church either. The other thing I'm very, very passionate about is young women going and having mammograms. I would like the woman's health system to be changed a little bit. Our 40-year-old daughter diagnosed with breast cancer 2 weeks ago, had a full mastectomy. She wouldn't have gone if she didn't have such a pushy mother and people around her, but she went, and this is the outcome. So for me, I have a ministry called Healing Hands, where we put donations and we help families in need, not just women, but I would like the government to pay for women who have got breast cancer on both sides of the family to perhaps get a bit of discount for the mammogram that they need to have. So there's a whole lot of things, Lisa, that I am really passionate about.
Okay. You have said about the leadership of this country that you feel that there is a slide in values and morals. So what is the most harmful policies that you think that this current government has? Can you name me the most harmful policy?
Well, in the last few weeks, the really one that really, to me, has challenged me is not letting Man Up into the prison where...
That's not a policy though, Hannah.
Well, I'm not creating a policy-driven reply to you. What I'm saying is that I see how a great organisation who can help offenders being excluded by the deputy leader of the Labour Party.
I just want to be really clear about this, because you say that this party is separate to the church, and then you keep going back to the Man Up program. So is this political party about getting Man Up into the prisons?
Of course I'd like Man Up into the prison, but it's not just about Man Up.
Okay.
It's about families. It's about the family court. It's about the health for the woman.
Right.
It's about, you know, let's take our time.
And I did hear you when you've listed those.
Let's
I have
take
heard
our
that.
Time. Euthanasia, I'm, that really concerns me.
It's not a government policy currently. So introducing
but
your party,
yeah, but
you said
going
there were
to be.
Harmful policies.
Well, I
no, it's going
that.
To a vote. It's going
okay.
to a vote.
All right.
So you said there were harmful policies. Mm. What is the most harmful current policy?
Well,
that this government
to
has.
Be honest, Lisa, I would not really have an answer for that.
Why is that?
Because it's just from what I've observed over the last 6 months. I've seen so many different things, and I'm going to learn and develop along the way to naming specifically those things. But today, you know, I've had so many other things to do, but today is not the day that I'm going to be able to do that.
Okay.
I'm just being honest with you.
In terms of politics...
Yeah.
In terms of current MPs, who is the MP that you admire the most?
Well, I absolutely think Winston is awesome.
Would you like to work with Winston Peters and his party?
I just like Winston. I look, to be honest, we have not even discussed that. So I think as a leader, I'd have to be fair to the team that works with me. I just don't want to go off and say, this is definitely what we're going to do, because
but there must be some parties that you think you're more compatible with. So what are your thoughts on who you're
actually I really liked I like Shane Jones. I quite like Shane Jones.
Sounds like you're leaning towards New Zealand First here, Hannah.
Well, I suppose I just like them for, I know we do have a relationship with Willie Jackson. Who else do I have a passion for? Well, I suppose I just look and I just think, oh, this person's really good and that person's really good. But to be honest, I think it'd be unfair for
okay.
me to continue to name people, because then it looks like I'm isolating other people that I may actually enjoy getting to know.
Your husband's not yet sure what role he'll play in this, and you're not saying yet whether he'll stand in a seat. I'm just wondering, will you stand in an electorate? I'm not asking you to tell me which one, but
yes, I'd like
you
to.
Personally will
yeah,
stand
I would
in
like
an electorate.
To.
Okay. Your husband has made the comment previously that there are a lot of perverts in Parliament. Do you share his view?
Well, after the news over the last few days, I would say that I think one's been excommunicated out of the house now, so maybe that one's gone. I don't know whether there's been bullying.
Do you think there's others?
There's been a whole lot of things. Well, I don't know. You might be able to tell me, because I really don't know all the
that
facts.
That comment wasn't in relation to that.
Okay. Is that what I said, Lisa?
No, that's what your husband
okay,
said. So
well,
I'm wondering
you know
if you share
hey,
that view.
Let him have his say, and I'll speak for myself.
You want us
myself.
To get to know you, so
yeah,
I'm asking
exactly.
you. Do you think that Parliament
well,
is full
I think
of
that
perverts?
Brian and I will be separated in some of the things that we say, because I'm not accountable for his
absolutely
his
you
words.
Are not. That is
because I'm a woman in my
you.
Own right.
Yep.
And I'd like to be judged as a woman in my own right.
I want to be really clear about what your view is on homosexual relationships, gay relationships. What is your view?
I have got family that are gay. They know I love them.
Do you approve of homosexual relationships? Does God approve of homosexual relationships?
Well, I'm not God, Lisa.
No, but you,
don't
preached,
ask me.
You preached the word of,
can,
so I'm
yes,
wanting
yes,
to know
yes, yes,
your
but
view.
Let's put it this way. If a friend of mine is gay and they don't believe in God, don't love God, their choice. If they decided they wanted to live the Christian life I live, then there might be some decisions they have to make. I talk to...
What does that mean? Can you be gay and a Christian?
I see Professor Linehan. We talked with him, and he told us openly that he was gay, and he is...
I'm asking you your views, because you say you want us to know you, right?
Yeah.
So I do want to know exactly what you think here, and I want you to be really clear with me.
Yeah.
So on the issue of people...
Do I think a gay person can be a Christian?
I'm asking you what your overriding view is.
I think a gay person can be a Christian.
Are they sinning by being gay?
Well,
or being
I might
in a gay
be sinning if I
lie
to you, Lisa. I might be sinning if I beat my husband. I might be sinning if I'm gambling away our household money.
If you're asking people
to vote
for you,
I'm not
really
going to let
you
put
this.
Me in a box. I'm saying sin is sin, regardless of to what degree it is. If I steal a lollipop from a dairy and I steal a car off the car lot, to me, that's a sin, regardless of the measure of it.
So is gayness a sin?
Fornication is a sin. Adultery is a sin.
Is gayness a sin?
Well, I don't know. Would they see it as a sin?
I'm asking you.
Yes, in my perspective, I would see it that way, as much as somebody that beat their wife, as much as anybody else. But this is the thing, Lisa. Our Lord is a gracious God. And because of the grace that he's shown to me, while I was in sin, when I lived in sin, when I had a child out of wedlock, the graciousness he showed me, I believe he's capable of showing it to everybody else.
So if a gay person repents, then...
If a gay people gives their life to the Lord and lives there according to the way they see God, who am I to judge them? I'm not God, Lisa, let's get that clear. I'm not God.
No, but you said you want us to get to know you, so I think if
but
you're
asking
people...
But why do you only want to get to know me in one area?
No,
it's like,
I don't.
No. It's like you are deliberately trying to discredit. So what about all the
I'm
other areas
you to
in
be
my
clear
life?
Clear on your
I've
position.
Made it clear.
What's your position on immigration?
Well, I think we should look after New Zealanders first. There are a lot of New Zealanders that aren't housed. So I just think, let's help some of our Kiwis get homes. Let's put some of them into work.
So are we allowing too many people to come and live in our country from overseas?
At this moment, at this time, while we're lacking work, while we're unemployment, while we're lacking housing, I think we may be. But who knows in the future, when we start housing our own people, caring for our own people, having our people getting jobs, maybe there'll be a time when we can open the gates a little bit wider. I'm not saying close them. I'm just saying let's be a little bit more mindful about New Zealanders.
So would that mean lowering the numbers of people who are coming in? Would
well,
you bring down the rate?
I currently don't know how many are coming in. So do you have the number?
Not off the top of my
head. Oh, no, I don't know the number either.
So, but you think maybe we're letting too many people into the country?
Well, I'm not sure. If I knew how, if it was like 500 a year, well, is that too much? No. I think 5,000 a year might be too much.
Should we raise the debt cap to spend more on social services and what to?
Is that a policy around, I'm not sure what you're meaning. Do you think that we should be giving more money to social services? Because I think they already have a lot of money given to them.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, every day there seems to be multi-millions of dollars given to the social needs in our communities.
So,
and that's good. Hey, I don't have a problem with that. I think it's great.
A current recommendation of a welfare report was to raise the level of benefits. Mm. Would you support raising the level of benefits by up to 48%?
I actually think that might be a good idea if... the parents were measured on what they spent the money on. Like if it was, we knew that it was going to the children, to the household needs. Not that I can tell everyone what to do and how to do a budget, but I think it would be great if they could be a little bit more accountable, give them a little bit more to help them through their struggle.
But track their expenditure?
Not totally, just making sure that the children's well-being, the children have shoes when they need them, that they have food in their tummy when they need it. That would be all.
And just to be clear, the funding for this political party, is any of it coming from Destiny Church?
Absolutely not. So, absolutely not.
So how are you going to fund it?
I've already had a few friends say that they would help us. We've got friends outside the church that will help us. So we've got many business people in the church. If they want to give to us personally, give to the party personally, that's their choice.
Have you
signed... Where do other parties get their money from?
Donations.
Yeah, what'll be donations? Same.
Have you managed to sign any people up yet? How many members have you got so far?
Not telling.
The people... have you managed to sign 1, 2, 3 people up yet?
Not telling.
Okay, could you just give us give us a little tidbit, Hannah?
You're funny.
Who might be on your list that we're interested in? Who might be on your party list?
No. Not
Clue?
Telling.
Anyone from the sporting world?
Not telling. No, not from over there, not the Mozzies.
anyone from, formerly from the Māori Party?
Haven't talked to anyone.
Hannah, have you spoken to anyone from the Māori Party directly?
We went to a tangi. Recently, and there were a few people there from the Māori Party, but we did not talk about this.
You didn't talk about politics or joining forces?
No.
You said...
Haleana's husband's passing.
Who is your core supporter? Describe that person to me. Who do you think it is?
Tall,
who are you going to appeal to?
Dark, handsome, gives good kisses, beautiful to me, treats me like a queen.
So you're talking about the man who supports you the most. Yeah. I'm asking you the people that you think will sign up to your party. Who do you appeal to?
I've got a lot of really good friends that...
Beyond them, though? Beyond them, who are you appealing to with this
party?
Well,
I've met a whole lot of different people outside of church. I think if you've seen me on Facebook and stuff, you'll see that I go out on a regular basis with a lot of friends.
So are they urban? Are they suburban? Are they Pākehā? Are they
Māori? Pākehā, Māori, island people, elderly people, young people. Hey, I'm open to all people. New Zealand, I'm here.
Coalition New Zealand leader Hannah Tamaki with Lisa Owen on Checkpoint. And you can watch that interview from the Checkpoint page of rnz.co.nz. Simon Bridges has spoken with the National List MP Alfred Ngaro about his potential plan to set up a Christian Values Party, but the party leader says National is not involved. A potential coalition partner, Mr. Ngaro, is being criticised for sharing an anti-abortion post on his Facebook page last weekend, which describes abortion as an unholy holocaust in our nation. Mr. Bridges joined Corin Dan in our Wellington studio on Monday's Morning Report.
Well, firstly, on the Alfred Ngaro issue, on Friday we got a text from you or your office saying that this was all rumour and speculation. Mm. Did you forget to tell us that you had actually talked to him about this issue a month ago?
Well, the truth is the story, I suppose, had some parts of it that were substantive and based on substance. Some of it was wrong, and so that's the reality of it. I mean, the situation is pretty simple. A month or two ago, Alfred Ngaro came to me. He said that he has been approached by people around New Zealand about this. It's in the very early stages. And my position is effectively, oh, cool, that's fine. Let's see how you get on. Come back to me when you've got more news.
Did you ask, does he want to be in the party or not? I mean, it's a loyalty issue for the National Party, isn't it?
Well, it's not in as much as, it's not that I don't think he's unhappy. Well, I know he's not unhappy being a National, but he's also got this, in a sense, opportunity. And, you know, he's going to have to weigh that up and decide because...
Why are you letting him sort of have this time to go off and muse about leaving your caucus? Oh, he's a senior sort of MP, isn't he?
Pretty simple, because, look, there is an allure to this. But what is also true is he's going to have to weigh up the cost in terms of a big job setting up a political party, the organisation of it and so on, and they are all matters for him. I mean, the cost for me is not much. I'm simply giving the guy some space.
Okay, what is the allure?
Well, it's pretty simple, isn't it? If you look at New Zealand today and you look back over history, we've had similar parties actually do 4.7%, 4% under Colin Craig. And so there is certainly, you know, if you want to put it in this way, a gap in the market.
But this is the bit I don't understand. You're a broad church, right?
Correct.
You are a Christian conservative yourself, aren't you?
Correct, I'm a Christian.
Scott Morrison, evangelical Christian.
But I am not
Why do you need to have a faith-based party when clearly the current political system is dealing with those issues?
I wouldn't say we need to. I'm not a Christian politician. I've got a broad party that has all the views on the spectrum, frankly, when it comes to, if you like, moral issues. But Alfred's exploring it, I'm happy enough to give him
that's interesting. So you're not a Christian politician, so why is there a place for Christian politicians with faith-based policies
in the
Parliament?
Do you know what, ultimately, that's sort of not for me to decide. That's for New Zealanders to do. But the truth is this, if we go back over history, there has been quite strong, in minor party terms at least, support for this. Look, if it happens, great. If it doesn't, fine. Alfred's got a space and time here to work that out for himself.
Should faith play a role in political parties? Just your view on that.
Oh, look, I think it would be artificial to say that it shouldn't. You know, we live in a complicated, diverse world where people are allowed their views.
And that's what conscience votes do, though, isn't it? That's the mechanism that allows politicians to have those views.
Well,
so,
mean,
again,
Corin,
why do we need a party?
Ultimately, Corin, you're in a sense getting me to justify this. I'm not there trying to run a values or a faith-based party. I want to be in the National Party. I think the issues for New Zealand are primarily about economy and public services. Now, Alfred, it seems, takes a slightly different view. I'm merely giving him the space to have a look at that.
And if he was successful and got 5%, yep, and then you're dealing with him, well, then he's going to presumably want something forward supporting you.
Well, we know that story, don't we? It's called MMP. We've got a guy called Winston Peters, a wily old rooster, who chose the last Prime Minister. A lot of people are very frustrated about that. They do want to see other options. My position is vote for National, make us the strongest you can, but there's other options out there and they're emerging.
On that note, what will you work with Winston Peters at the next election?
I will be crystal clear with New Zealanders. Look, actually, like John Key was when he was Prime Minister at the start of next year about our positioning. Look,
so you'll give us a yay or a nay?
I will give you my position quite clearly. New Zealanders will know which political parties I, the National Party, and the National Party want to work with.
What about the so-called dirty deal in Botany? Can you rule out that you would do a dirty deal, an electorate deal, in that seat?
Yes. We will stand a National candidate and we will win that seat for National.
Is it appropriate that, putting aside that his desires to look at a potential another party, yep, that Alfred Naro is retweeting or, sorry, resharing posts describing abortion as a holocaust?
Well, of course, abortion is a conscience issue. My position on that is actually people, including members in Parliament, are allowed strong, actually really strong, some, in fact, very emotive views. That's what Alfred has done. I think, actually, they should be entitled to.
It's one of those words, though, isn't it? It's one of those words, holocaust. It's pretty out there. I know that, you know, we've got a debate, raging debate on free speech, but are you happy with that word?
Well, if you're asking me, would I say it? No, I wouldn't. But Alfred Naro has posted a post on that. My view is on a conscience issue in a broad church. We talked about this just before the National Party. People are allowed their views on these things.
So just to be clear, you're quite happy for him to go off, flirt with the idea of another political party, share a post with an extreme view on abortion, and there's no problem in terms of his role in the National Party.
You say that. I mean, I think the truth is there will be a bunch of New Zealanders with a range of views on these things, and let's see where the government gets to on the substantive issue of abortion. My position is Alfred's exploring something. There's really no cost to me in him doing that. I'm giving him the space to do that. He hasn't got a massive period of time, but that's something for
him
to
weigh. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because abortion has become a much bigger issue over the last wee while with what's happening in America. Where have you landed in terms of these three options of taking abortion out of the crime, stopping it being a crime, and potentially removing the test of having to get a doctor?
I'll be clear with you. I want to be keep my powder dry. I want to see what the government proposes. You say three options. I am not at all clear about where the government is going.
Well, let's just make it simple for you then. Do you support stopping it being a crime?
Well, look, as I say, I think I want to see what they're proposing. I don't think that's unreasonable. The reality of this is, and the government's clearly...
Hang on, what's unreasonable? You don't think it's unreasonable for me to
keep my powder dry and see where they land? Because let's understand this. My sense is they were going to come out in December last year with their position. They still haven't, as a government, put forward what the legislation is. They are clearly, it seems to me, finding this more complicated than just the one, two, three options. And I do want to see where they land. I'll take a considered view. Obviously, for the National Party, as I say, whether it's marijuana, whether it's abortion, whether it's other issues, there will be many views from, you know, say, Nikki Kaye or Paula Bennett will have a clear position through to, look, Alfred Naro and others.
But as a Christian conservative, you've said yourself, will you look to lead on these issues? Will you take a leadership role, even if they are conscience issues?
My clear thrust in politics has been around, actually, what we've just seen in Australia, what ScoMo called the quiet Australians. They're here in New Zealand too. All they really want from a government is a strong economy, good public services, and for us to get out of the way and let them get on with their families. And that's what drives me, not these moral, to use your words, quote, conservative issues.
Do you think that was the main reason for the election result, that there was some sort of silent majority out there that suddenly came out that were unhappy?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think the Liberals had a very good campaign, but I think it ultimately comes down to economic and fiscal issues, where the positioning of the two big parties was very opposed, and the middle decided they didn't want big tax regulation, unions back in, wasteful spending. They wanted to see workers with families.
There's other views as well, though, isn't it? And I think Audrey Young in the Herald was writing about this, that it was about leadership too, and about the fact that Bill Shorten perhaps didn't resonate with the public.
Save that. The reality of that is, and okay.
But is that a warning to you, as someone who's struggling to resonate at 5 or 6% of the preferred prime minister?
I think that's with the greatest respect to her, Audrey, struggling to find a New Zealand relevance, and good for her. The truth is, if you look at those polls, and let's be honest, bugger the pollsters in this case, but that wasn't where it was at. I think it was, to use your words, a silent majority, middle Australia coming out on the economy and where they saw things going under Labor.
But does it also show, because some would argue, does it also show that it's going to be very difficult for any opposition to present a, you know, fairly radical policy platform? Now, whether you agree with that or not, but the idea of progressive change, big change, the electorate, an older electorate, baby boomer electorate, call it what you will, is not going to buy it.
I think it does come down to, of course it does, and that's why I said a good campaign, clarity of message. I think the truth is it looks like Bill Shorten's campaign was scattergun. They were all over the show. Believe you me, the National Party won't be making that mistake. I would argue to New Zealanders right now, you've got a government without any clarity. They're not delivering. They're not sure what they stand for.
Are you going to have a big, wide policy platform?
And the National Party, which knows quite simply where I'm going with an election, which is a government not delivering and a National Party on the economy and public services and infrastructure that will.
Will you have a tax policy that will deal with the housing inequality in New Zealand?
Well, ultimately we'll have a tax policy which is about letting Kiwis keep more of their hard-earned money. It's as simple as that.
Just one last quick question. Bank capital requirements, this Reserve Bank policy of making banks hold a whole bunch of money in their vault, $20 billion or something, do you consider this a risk? The banks are saying it's a risk to the economy.
Yes, I do, because I think what it has the capacity to do is both increase the cost of capital, which has a real effect on the economy, particularly our primary production sector, and also actually the level of and the amount of borrowing that could happen. I think at the let's say, bold level at which the Governor and the Reserve Bank are doing, it will have a real impact on the economy, a negative impact.
The National Party leader Simon Bridges on Morning Report. A parliamentary staffer has been stood down after another staff member came forward and laid a formal complaint of sexual assault. On Wednesday morning, the Speaker, Trevor Mallard, said he believed three cases of extremely serious sexual assaults cited in a report into Parliament's workplace culture were rape. The damning independent report revealed rampant bullying, bad behaviour and sexual assaults in the corridors of power. Our political editor, Jane Patterson, filed this for Wednesday's Checkpoint programme on how that day unfolded.
This morning, the Speaker said it was his impression from the report that the assaults constituted rape, and he had the sense the man is still on the premises. Mr Mallard said he didn't know if it was an MP or a staffer, but if he did know who it was, he'd go to the police. The fallout from the report has seen party leaders coming and going to the Speaker's office, which has been a hive of activity today. National's Deputy Leader Paula Bennett told reporters this was an extremely serious situation, and the Speaker should involve the police immediately.
There are people here that are feeling unsafe at the moment. I personally am dealing with staff that are feeling very vulnerable and upset and describe themselves as feeling ill and uncomfortable and nervous.
Paula Bennett acknowledges people came forward because they were promised anonymity, and she respects their continued right to privacy. But she says she also has concerns for the welfare of people working there if they feel there's a known rapist walking the halls of Parliament. She says the duty of care is with the Speaker, but also extends to the report's author, Debbie Francis, if she holds information that would give any clue as to who that person is.
For me, it almost feels like they are harbouring a criminal. If they know who it is, I feel they have a responsibility on behalf of us all.
She's advising women at Parliament not to walk around alone if they're feeling unsafe. But Ms Bennett says it's the Speaker's job to make sure everyone does feel safe.
We have a responsibility to providing a safe workplace, and I don't think I can stand here confidently and say that's happening right now. And the Speaker has a responsibility to make sure that's happening.
The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, met with the Speaker this morning and says Trevor Mallard gave her an assurance he's taking steps to ensure Parliament is a safe place to work.
At that point, I suggested that a meeting with all party leaders would be one way for him to communicate what he was doing, what steps he was actively taking to ensure the security of Parliament. That happened at 12:45 this afternoon. At that meeting again, we were all given assurances by the Speaker that he was taking appropriate steps to make sure that this is a safe place for people to work.
Ms Ardern was asked what she thought of Paula Bennett's call to involve the police.
All of the advice over the years that I've had from people who are experts who have worked with victims is that we need to first ensure that victims have all the support they need, but that everything actually needs to be decided by them. So the choice of reporting to the police is ultimately for them. Then, though, the responsibility, regardless of their decision upon us, is to make sure that this is a safe working environment.
Mid-afternoon, Mr Mallard fronted to the media.
A member of the Parliamentary Service staff has been stood down following a historic allegation of assault. I don't want to cut across any employment or possible police investigations, but I am satisfied that the Parliamentary Service has removed a threat to the safety of women working in the parliamentary complex.
He thanked the staff member who came forward.
This is obviously a very traumatic time for that individual, and will also be the case for other individuals, other women who are involved.
He appealed to the media to let the process run its course, and he says it's not his role to refer this complaint to the police.
It is the role of the woman involved. One, you know, it is part of the ethics of New Zealand that you don't refer these matters to the police unless the individual wants to. That is a decision for her. Obviously, I would prefer if she did, but I will not be pressuring her.
Mr Mallard says it's his understanding the same person was responsible for all three serious cases of sexual assault highlighted by Debbie Francis, but he says he'll be making no further comment as the matter's now under investigation.
Our political editor, Jane Patterson, with that report from Checkpoint. The Civil Aviation Authority's director says the watchdog was confused about its safety role, and that confusion contributed to a helicopter crash that killed seven people. Graham Harris concedes the authority failed in its regulatory role to scrutinise operators and keep the public safe. He says staff weren't clear whether their job was to help operators keep flying or to be a strong regulator. His comments come after the release of a Transport Accident Investigation Commission report into a 2015 helicopter crash that killed seven people. It found fault with the operator and the Civil Aviation Authority. Graham Harris told Corin Dan on Thursday night the Commission's report was particularly confronting, but it mirrors their own findings.
What it highlights from my perspective is poor performance, regulatory performance by the organisation in the lead-up to the crash, particularly in the period around 2011 to 2012.
And this is the bit that I'm finding hard to get my head around looking into this case. There have been repeated warnings along these lines for decades about civil aviation not following up with these types of issues, of not holding these companies to the proper scrutiny. So why has it continued to happen?
First point is, it hasn't continued to happen in recent years. But I fully acknowledge that through a combination of OAG reports, and there's been other warnings in the past, the Air Adventures crash in Christchurch, and our own work, as I say, around the performance leading up to this, around that period.
So who's going to be held accountable? At some point, somebody has to be held accountable, don't they?
Yeah, let's... Can I finish the question about the why issue? I would put it down really to a really difficult issue that we've confronted in recent years, and it's probably a number of factors. One's a confusion about role. So why does the organisation exist? And I think that probably leading up to about 2012 or so, the organisation was conflicted and confused somewhat about what's our role here? We're aviation technical experts. Is our role when we go out and look at these operators, and this one's an example, is our role to try and help them, to try and keep them in the system? Or is our role, which we clearly know now,
to be enforcement?
Regulator, to be a strong regulator acting in the public interest. And I think there was certainly a period of confusion in that area. I think related to that was the organisation overvalued technical expertise rather than regulatory skills. So those first two things are involved. And then, finally, up until, November 2012, the organisation was significantly underfunded and under-resourced, which has been fixed in recent years.
But there are some who'd say if the CAA had been doing its job, the helicopter wouldn't have taken off.
let's be clear, the CAA can't be everywhere and it can't be sitting beside every pilot and it can't be sitting at every heliport and so on. So ultimately, the responsibility is the operator. And in my view, this operator put this pilot in a really unfortunate position, didn't support them. Their management structures and all that were missing. But you're right to a degree. My view is the CAA failed in its regulatory role to ensure that this operator met the standards.
So I'll come back to my point. Yeah. Is anybody going to be held accountable at CAA for that so that the message gets through that it's not acceptable?
Well, the problem is that some of those failings back then were systemic failings. And I know there's been a good deal of, you know, people have spoken about, you know, the inspectors didn't raise issues. They noted problems when they were down there. They didn't bring them back. But actually, I would put that down to the organisation generally. I'd put it down to, comes down to that confusion about identity, confusion about role. I'd put it down to, you know, team leaders not mentoring, coaching, managers not managing, right? So if you want to talk about individuals, then, you know, I'm a bit stuck because actually there's very few of the individuals involved from back then still with the organisation. In fact, none of the flight ops inspectors who were involved with this operator still work for the organisation.
Okay.
So a little difficult.
Why should we have confidence, though, that these problems are going to be addressed in the future? How many inspectors have you got now?
So let's be clear, we're talking about in the helicopter air transport sector.
Yes.
Off the top of my head, there's an establishment of 8, and we've got, once again, off the top of my head, we've got 3 vacancies, so we've got 5 at the moment.
So you're struggling to fill those positions?
I wouldn't say we're struggling to fill them. We have had a reasonable turnover. We always have a reasonable turnover, and it is always difficult to find the people with the technical knowledge.
And how many helicopters and operators do those 5 inspectors have to cover?
There are something like roughly 100, you know, slightly over 100 operators. And on the National Register of Helicopters, there's just over 800. Having said that, a lot of those there'll be a reasonable number of recreational, there'll be a reasonable number.
And you're asking these inspectors to not just do their auditing, they have to verify everything, right? They can't just take the word of the operator, which is the problem in this case.
Absolutely. So don't take things at face values. Verify.
And do you have the tools to send a message to the operators that if they don't comply, if they don't tell you the truth about their operations, you will hammer them and you will ground them?
Yes, absolutely. And we're clear about our regulatory role now. And we have been absolutely clear about our regulatory role for a number of years.
So you're clear that prior to 2012, you're saying it was unclear as to whether or not you were the person who was to lay down the law. You're clear that that's your role now. When do we see those sort of penalties? You need to make an example of somebody, don't you? Are there going to be random audits? Because it's the only way operators, you can't get to every operator on every day, you've said that. They need to know that if they breach the rules, they'll be hammered.
If you look back in some of the media coverage in the last couple of years, you'll find that there have been a couple of occasions where we have grounded operators and various aviation sector commentators have accused us of being overzealous. I disagree with them entirely, but what that indicates is we're clear about our role now. We're not going to do what happened in this case, is work with an operator while they come back into compliance. We're going to protect the public by taking vigorous action straight away.
And just finally, I mean, for the families involved, this is very difficult. Some of them feel and are pointing the finger at you and your organisation. They feel that it's not up to scratch. What can you say to them?
I can offer them an absolute assurance that it is up to scratch now, that the lessons taken from this tragic crash have been learned, and we're now acting vigorously in the public interest.
The director of the Civil Aviation Authority, Graham Harris, as heard on Friday's morning report. Confusion reigns over the future of Huawei phones in New Zealand. Google has announced it will limit the software services it provides Huawei after a White House order last week that restricted the Chinese company's access to American technology. Technology commentators here have suggested that if Huawei phones can no longer receive security updates, then owners should return their phones to retailers and get a refund. Andrew Bowater is Huawei New Zealand's deputy chief executive. He joined Corinne Dan on Wednesday's morning report.
And there has actually been a brief reprieve, hasn't there? A three-month time delay on some of these restrictions. Is that likely to be significant for you?
Yeah, well, look, we're still getting to grips with the whole impact of this announcement. And it's a shame for New Zealand consumers, obviously, that they've been caught up in this. But the important point is that we've come out and said that we'll continue to support the phones. And Google has also said the same. So anybody that has a Huawei phone currently in the market, you know, there's no need to panic or rush back to retailers yet. There is, you know, no need to do anything like that because we've said we'll continue to support the phones. They'll continue to get updates, and Google has said the same.
Right. So just to be clear, if they ask to update their phone, so there's a new version of Google Maps, you're saying that they will be able to get that?
Yeah, Google Apps. So Google has said they'll continue to get support for the apps on existing phones in the market, so there'll be no change there. So if you're an existing Huawei customer, there's really no change at this stage. It's more about future devices.
Yeah, so if a new edition of Huawei's phones comes out and it comes to New Zealand, there's no guarantee then you would be able to get the update. So that is potentially going to hurt your business, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, as I said, you know, it's a real shame for the consumers, and particularly the New Zealanders. You know, we've had a lot of growth in the consumer market for our business, particularly with the latest series of phones. And so we know that we've had a lot of support from our customers as well. So we know there's a lot of support for our devices out there. So that is disappointing for them, that, you know, the future New Zealanders may miss out on the best. But we've said we'll, you know, look at the longer term impact of this announcement. But also work on contingencies.
New phones, I'll get to the contingencies, but new phones are what come out every couple of years, don't they? So, you know.
Every couple of months.
Well, there you go. So the impact could be quite quick, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I mean, I think this is another sign of the bigger, I guess, geopolitical game that's been at play here, you know, against our business. So this is just another, you know, hurdle for us to jump over. But look, we're willing to confront that, and you know we'll take it on and look at whatever contingencies right. We can do to continue to support our customers.
So you got, I see the White House has given a 3 month delay. So is that long enough to get your own operating systems? Because at the moment, right, you're using Google's Android. You don't have your own operating system yet, do you?
No, not yet. But we do. We have obviously, you know, this is just, you know, widely anticipated and, you know, slightly predictable from the US. You know that they continue to go after us like this. You know, I mean, it's been no secret that they've been, you know, out there going after us for a long time. So, you know, we have been prepared for this. We've been, you know, stockpiling chipsets and whatnot to prepare for the worst. And, you know, we had already started work on alternatives. But also, the Android platform is an open source platform. You know, we're one of the biggest contributors to that in the world. We're Google's second biggest customer in that space at the moment. So we've been heavily involved in the development of Android over the years. So we've got a lot of knowledge there ourselves and how that could work into the future. But right now, you know, there's no change for any Huawei customer in the New Zealand market. So, you know, if you've got a Huawei phone, there is no change right now.
Okay, but you mentioned yourself the geopolitical issues, and for many commentators would argue what we are seeing now is the start of a split, a technological, well, Cold War, some people have put it, where basically countries like New Zealand are going to be asked to choose between whether they want the US technology or whether they want to use Chinese and other countries' technologies. Is that how you see it, and are we, you know, have to make a choice here?
Well, you know, look, nobody wants, you know, another split. I mean, if we all remember back to the days of the old, you know, CDMA networks and GSM networks, you know, where you had difficulty roaming if you were a telecom customer, you know, as opposed to, you know, a Vodafone customer back in the day. Nobody wants to go back to that sort of split in technology of two worlds of, you know, different ecosystems out there. That's no good for consumers to go down that line. So, you know, the industry has been working closely together on standards over the years. But now you've got this other sort of trade war, geopolitical game that's at play. And unfortunately, our New Zealand, you know, consumers and whatnot are just caught in the middle of this.
Will there be a split?
We hope not. And there's really no need for there to be one. And it's really not best for consumers. You know, the industry is quite aligned on this. You know, we all work closely together behind the scenes on standards when it comes to new technologies and how they all work. And we actually, you know, like we're a close partner of Google's globally, you know. And as I said, we help develop Android with them.
Sure.
So, you know, we all work cohesively together because we recognise it's in nobody's interest to have that sort of split.
Huawei New Zealand's Deputy Chief Executive Andrew Bowater on Morning Report. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, accused mosque gunman faces terrorism charge and a family reunion 100 years in the making.
Well, he's been most probably about a month just to write up his story and then try and get hold of relatives.
Still to come in The Week in Review. After multiple obstacles and delays, the first steps in a $36 million plan to explore the 2.3-kilometre-long entry tunnel at the Pike River mine have been taken. Families of victims were emotional Tuesday after a three-person team entered the mine to begin the search for remains and clues as to what caused the explosion which killed 29 men in 2010. Tracy Keane-Harvey, whose son Ricky died in the disaster, hopes for justice.
It was very emotional. It was hard them looking back and seeing all the lights, you know, something that we wish we could have seen nearly 9 years ago. But It has been good finally to, you know, get to this stage, and maybe, just maybe, one day one of us may be lucky, and also to have some justice for all of our men.
Dave Gorn is Chief Executive of the Pike River Recovery Agency. He joined Corin Dan on Wednesday's Morning Report.
How did it feel yesterday to finally be able to deliver some hope there for those families?
Yeah, it was great. You know, it was there were tears and cheers, as you just heard. But it is it's a first small step, but very, very significant, particularly for the families. But I shouldn't underestimate, or we shouldn't underplay, the amount of work that still has to be done for the next stages.
Did everything go to plan? Is everything looking how it should in terms of oxygen levels, these sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. The mine behaves exactly as we expected. And in fact, as Kirk Nielsen said, who was in the mine just before it was sealed at the 30-metre seal, he said that, you know, from what he saw and what he observed, nothing had changed in terms of the environment or the infrastructure and everything else that was inside the mine. So, you know, that's very positive and certainly points to smoother rides ahead, I guess, in terms of what we anticipate finding in the mine itself.
Yeah, how quickly can you go? So what happens today, for example? Do you just start going in and further and, you know, checking along the way?
Yeah, essentially. We'll be doing a few more reviews of the risk assessments in terms of the next stages, but later on this afternoon they'll continue to advance the vent bags and the ventilation system up to the 170-metre mark, and then the work will continue, and that includes just upgrading the 170-metre seal to a rated or engineered specific design.
So what happens at that point? What's the process for going through that 170-metre mark?
Well, once we've rated the seal, that will give us the opportunity to... We'll actually pause for a bit just so that we can do some pressure tests and understand what's happening with the ventilation and the atmosphere behind the 170-metre mark. And then after about 5 to 7 days, we will then start to disestablish the 30-metre seal, remove all of the water infrastructure, and that'll take about 6 to 8 weeks. As that process is being undertaken by the guys up at the site, Dingy, myself, and other experts will be putting together the final detail in terms of the plan to go in beyond the 170-metre seal. And that plan in part depends on what we learn in terms of how our mine actually responds to our activities in that next 6 to 8 weeks.
And just remind people, how far are you looking to get? Where does it start to be? You start to get to a point in the drift where you haven't been really, and where you might be able to find something potentially new.
And nobody has been beyond about 300 metres. Dingy led a team of mines rescue personnel when they first sighted the 170-metre seal. That took them through to about 300 metres. Beyond that, there has been some camera work down some of the boreholes, and we've had robots right up to Russell Smith's loader at about the 1500 metre mark. Beyond that, you know, we have an idea of what's there from the video footage, but not really any certainty. But it's really once we get up to pit bottom and stone that the sort of forensics part really takes on a new sort of level, and that's the area of particular significance forensically. Beyond that, at about 1,900 metres through to 2,300 metres where the roof fall is, that's a bit trickier, and we don't know a lot about that. It hasn't really been explored. We know that there is a debris field, but it's also in the area of the Hawera Fault. So,
How far can you go in terms of your resourcing? Let's say everything goes to plan in terms of gases and things. Will you just keep going until it gets to a point where it's unsafe or the resourcing isn't there?
Well, certainly our mandate is up to the 2,300 metre mark, and that is up to the roof fall. Beyond that, and it is beyond that that the last known location of the 29 men were, beyond that is another kettle of fish altogether. But our mandate is just to the roof fall, if we can get that far.
And how long do you think, best case scenario, if things are as stable as they have been, how long do you think it might take to get there?
We still anticipate being able to meet our originally planned timelines, which would see us handing back the mine to dock by the end of this year. Now, to get to pit bottom and stone, we're probably not looking at that before about August of this year.
And is it just the three of you that would go that far, or do police forensics start going in as well?
Now, the intent is to build a ventilation control device on the other side, so that's on the inside of pit bottom and stone. And that will be an engineered design, a rated seal, and that will enable us to control and have a very stable atmosphere, which will enable the police experts to come in should they be comfortable to do so.
The Chief Executive of the Pike River Recovery Agency, Dave Gorn, on Morning Report. The police have charged the accused mosque gunman with engaging in a terrorist act. They say the charge under the Terrorism Suppression Act has been filed against Brenton Tarrant following a meeting with the victim's families and survivors in Christchurch. The charge will allege that a terrorist act was carried out in Christchurch on the 15th of March 2019 and follows consultation between police, Crown Law and the Christchurch Crown Solicitor's Office. An additional murder charge and two additional attempted murder charges have also been filed. Law Professor Bill Hodge joined Lisa Owen on Tuesday's Checkpoint program.
Bill, what does this mean in practical terms?
What it means, and I have to say I'm a bit disappointed, I understand that it's satisfying to use the word terrorism in the prosecution, like the word hate crime. But we don't know what the definition will be upheld by the court, and he will be able to give evidence. I'm not a terrorist, I'm a patriot. Read my manifesto. I'm here to help the New Zealand people, not to cause terrorism. So he's going to be able to give evidence on the meaning of the term, where if they had stuck with the concept of murder, that would not be relevant, and the judge would be able to shut down cross-examination or an attempt to give a speech. Whereas with terrorism, we have never had a prosecution, we've never had an appeal, we've never tested the meaning of it, so both he will be able to give evidence and he will be able to appeal on any conviction. Although it's very satisfying to say, yes, he's a terrorist, he could get life under Section 6A of terrorism suppression, but every law student knows the definition of murder, the actus reus and mens rea, but nobody knows exactly what terrorism means.
So it's untested territory, and he could get a platform to espouse his beliefs. So
I like that word, platform. Yeah, he will be able to read his manifesto.
So is there any advantage to laying this charge?
Well, doesn't it feel good? I mean, I guess the police, the prosecution are making a statement, and the statement is welcome because we use this word terrorism. But our old statute, the good, tried-and-true Crimes Act, was very fit for purpose, whereas the Terrorism Suppression, or it's called the Terrorism Suppression Act, is novel, it's never been tried, and it'll be an experiment, in my view, although it, quote, feels good, but it's just a risk that he's going to get his platform, and that's really what he wanted.
What about penalties?
Well, the penalty for that section, 6A, is life. But the only question under the murder conviction, I don't want to be prejudicial to the trial. Let's assume he has a fair trial. If he's convicted on a murder charge, again, the only issue for the judge was, what is the non-parole period? So there was a life sentence already there in the charges, so the police got no additional sentencing ability or sentencing option by charging under Section 6A. So I guess it feels good, and I guess people would say, aha, we're going to charge this guy with terrorism. But how much further along are we in terms of pursuing justice if he is just given an international megaphone to spout that manifesto?
Law Professor Bill Hodge on Checkpoint. An investigation into a police pursuit in Palmerston North in which a 15-year-old boy and his 12-year-old passenger died has found the police never should have started the chase. Ehiah Maxwell and Meadow James died when the stolen car Ehiah was driving crashed into a ditch in May last year. The Independent Police Conduct Authority says the officer involved didn't properly assess the risk before signalling for the driver to stop and then starting the pursuit. Ehiah Maxwell's granddad, Dennis Maxwell, spoke to Lisa Owen on Checkpoint. He believes the chase was the wrong call.
Everything is beautiful in hindsight, isn't it? They knew who he was, so they knew he was a young offender. So, you know, did they really need to chase him? I don't think so. Was it the right thing to do? I don't think so.
Do you still not blame anyone in particular for what happened?
I don't blame them per se. I don't blame any person per se. I probably blame a system that is so gung-ho on, you know, the chase without really realising the consequences, especially where young people are concerned. I'm not the type of person who can judge anybody because I've made heaps of mistakes in my own life. You know, I was just lucky enough to survive them. In my boy's case, it just wasn't the case, you know. And unfortunately, it wasn't only him. It was another young life, an even younger life. But they knew who he was. Obviously, I don't know if they knew he was a passenger. Who was me in particular, and I'm not a policeman, that I was chasing a young 15-year-old, I doubt that I would have chased. I would have just went around his house and kicked his ass and then taken him from there. But, again, you know, I wasn't in the situation when this officer came across him. He obviously felt that that's what was required, and so it went from there.
What do you think, Dennis, are some of the things that contributed to your grandson dying at 15. What other things were in the mix?
Oh, lots of things. His zest for life, I guess, in a term, he was a very high-strung boy, you know, but he was a boy. And when I say high-strung, he was just hyper. Anyone who knows him, you know, knew he was just hyper as. He was full on, and the only thing that really, you know, slowed him down was Ritalin, which, you know, what a poor substitute that is. He was too much for today's society, I guess. That was part of it. Obviously, things outside, which I didn't really know were going on with him. I didn't realise he could drive a car. You know, I was talking to him about cars and things like that, and, you know, he wanted to get his licence, you know, all the things that young kids want to do.
So you didn't even know he could actually drive?
I didn't know he could drive, no. Until, so he had an incident earlier in the thing where he got pulled up in pram or something like that. And he was in jail there, and then I went and seen him, and I said, "Who the hell was driving?" He goes, "Oh, I was driving." You know, I didn't even know you could drive. I said, "Do you know how to drive?" He goes, "Oh, yeah." You know.
Ehiah was your first grandchild, and I imagine you had kind of big dreams and plans and hopes for him, and I imagine your family would have. So what has it meant to you all to lose him like this?
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, we still feel the impact today. you know, he's got siblings and, you know, they pine for him. His sister cries for him. His nieces and nephews, he got some young nieces and nephews too, and they just absolutely loved and adored him. So, you know, he was a character. He was huge in life. But he was definitely an awesome sports person, natural talent. So he, you know, he could have easily been an All Black or a Kiwi, a basketballer. He was good basketball. He was good at whatever he put his hand to. So, you know, it's been huge. It's been huge on the on our family.
What do you miss the most about not having him around?
Oh, just his cheekiness, his zest for life. He wanted to live life. You know, he wanted to live life. And again, you know, he was too much for. He was just full on. And you know, I really enjoyed that. I used to go and watch him play rugby. He was a prankster. He just loved life.
So we know now that the officer involved didn't properly assess the risk before trying to pull the car over and then starting the pursuit. So we know now that mistakes were made by the police. What do you want to happen now?
What do I want to happen? I want no more kids' lives to be lost. I believe there has to be a better way than catch them at all costs sort of mentality that we have at the moment. You know, when it happened, I didn't want to work. I was thinking, you know, what's the point? You know, I should be just staying home and looking after these kids and trying to put them in a, you know, on a better path rather than being at work, you know, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, you know, to make a living. You know, is that really what it's about? I'm not angry with the police. I'm angry with a system that wants to chase at all costs.
That's Dennis Maxwell, the grandfather of Ihiah Maxwell, who with Meadow James died in a car crash following a police pursuit in May last year. He was speaking to Lisa Owen on Thursday's Checkpoint program. Prominent lawyer Steph Dyberg is to investigate claims of homophobic and sexist behaviour made against several Crusaders players during a recent tour of South Africa. New Zealand Rugby and the Crusaders say they're treating the allegations seriously, but they say they don't match with the players' version of events. Timothy Brown filed this.
A South African woman claims the Crusaders and All Blacks' first five, Richie Mwanga, spat beer at her and behaved inappropriately during a tense exchange at a Cape Town bar.
Look at us. With a dead stare and just walked away, and then my friends and I are dancing, and then I noticed the guy walking behind me, and then he like pinched me on my bum.
It's one of two alleged incidents involving the Crusaders during a recent tour of South Africa. The other involving a group of men who claim they were mocked and subjected to homophobic comments by a group of players, including All Black George Bridge, while in a McDonald's restaurant during the weekend.
The guy in front of me, who was one of the rugby players, had his phone out and in that moment currently recording me for what looked like his Instagram or Snapchat and slowly zooming into my face and laughing at the same time as if he thought it was this hilarious video.
The players at the centre of the allegations have denied any wrongdoing, and Crusaders chief executive Colin Mansbridge says their accounts are very different to those of the complainants.
We've got a he said situation, and that's why we think an independent review is probably the best way to do it, and we're going to invite both complainants to contact Steph directly.
Mr. Mansbridge says in relation to the McDonald's incident, there is no suggestion the players were intoxicated, and coach Scott Robertson told reporters at Christchurch International Airport that the situation was a misinterpretation, an attempted selfie by George Bridge gone wrong. However, in the Mwanga incident, which occurred the week before the McDonald's exchange, the first five responded to a message on social media apologising for spitting beer at the woman. In the response, he says he doesn't recall the matter, but obviously was intoxicated and should have gone home long before that stage. But Mr. Mansbridge says Mwanga's lack of recollection and acceptance he was drinking should not be linked.
So in the apology, I think he says intoxication, and he says he doesn't remember the incident. It's easier to make the link. We'd like Steph Dyberg to have a look into that and get right to the bottom of it.
He says he has spoken to Mwanga, who was out with other players from the team, and his version of events is different to that detailed by the woman.
He's gutted. He's quite keen for, in fact, all the players involved are keen for this to be investigated by Steph.
Colin Mansbridge says the players remain available for selection while the matters are investigated. He says the McDonald's allegation is particularly gutting for the players as part of an inclusive organisation, the only Super Rugby team to be Rainbow Tick accredited.
Now, I've heard feedback from players, I've heard feedback from management, I've heard feedback from security staff that were there, and other independent people have made contact with us, and they suggest that there was no homophobic statements made.
The suggestion of a homophobic environment around the team also didn't marry with what Rawa Karatai, manager of the Christchurch Heroes, the city's first and only gay and inclusive rugby team, has seen.
The allegations are a surprise because they have been so supportive. They've got the Rainbow Tick and they do work well with us at Christchurch Heroes. We've had such a positive experience with Crusaders, both managerial and at players level.
New Zealand Rugby's Chief Rugby Officer, Nigel Cass, says the alleged behaviour has no place in the modern game and the organisation holds strong values of respect, inclusion and tolerance. However, the claims are refuted by the players and New Zealand Rugby and the Crusaders are awaiting the outcome of the investigation. Colin Mansbridge says the process will take as long as it needs.
Timothy Brown with that report from Monday's Checkpoint programme. Wasp numbers are increasing dramatically in Auckland and experts are warning the populations could climb higher if they're not controlled. Auckland Council has received more calls from people reporting wasps so far this year than during the whole of 2018. Wasps are such a pest in parts of the country that a SWAT team of experts has formed to find new ways to reduce their numbers. This report from Amy Williams from Morning Report.
They may be little, but the common wasp can rob beehives of honey and life, close down popular walking tracks, and endanger native wildlife. Here's one of the country's leading entomologists, Dr. Phil Lester from Victoria University, on one tactic of this cunning predator.
They might target one particular hive within an apiary. It might be a weaker hive or something like that. And they'll have an all-out assault on it where they assemble at the entrance. They'll kill the adult workers, the guards that are trying to block the wasps from entering it. And then they raid the hive, kill all the larvae, so the larvae are a good source of protein for wasps and their nest, and eat the honey, so they've got a sweet tooth, just like you and me.
In Auckland, parts of the Waitakere Ranges can become no-go zones for rangers when wasps are at their peak. The council has fielded 349 calls about wasps so far this year, with almost half reporting nests. Already, that's more than the 290 calls the council received last year. Council biosecurity advisor and entomologist Emma Edney Brown says this is peak season for common wasps, including paper wasps and yellow jackets, and last year's warm, dry spring and summer laid the groundwork for them to flourish.
We're actually getting quite a bit more in terms of complaints. I do happen to see them everywhere, but I don't know if that's because I'm keeping my eye out, because that's what I do. definitely noticing a lot more, particularly with the warm, dry weather at the moment, particularly this year.
A group formed to take the sting out of these invaders, the Wasp Tactical Group, is working with the National Science Challenge to lower the country's out-of-control wasp population. The group includes experts from universities and crown institutes, iwi, regional councils and the Department of Conservation. Phil Lester is among the experts concerned about wasps preying on indigenous species.
The group recognised that wasps are a considerable problem throughout New Zealand. So certainly that's the case in places like Nelson, where we see the highest wasp densities in the world. We have up to 40 nests per hectare in those regions where there's honeydew beech forest. But wasps are a problem throughout New Zealand, from Auckland right down to Southland.
Landcare researcher and entomologist Bob Brown is also part of the Wasp Tactical Group, and he works in a team that's searching for predators to attack the common wasp. Dr. Brown's been travelling to England, where the wasps introduced here originally hail from. He's brought back a species of hoverfly under quarantine to test how good they are at raiding wasp nests in the lab. He says these hoverflies have good potential as effective predators to keep the wasp population down.
These particular ones, the female lays her eggs on the outside of the wasp nest, so she'll fly straight down down the entrance of the wasp nest, lay her eggs on the outside of the wasp nest, and then those eggs hatch, crawl inside, and start feeding on the brood of the wasp.
Dr. Brown says the Landcare team is a few months away from seeking the Environment Protection Authority's permission to release an army of hoverflies to attack wasp nests. If the green light's given, it could take at least a year to release the critters. In the meantime, experts hope the days of dousing a wasp nest in petrol and setting it alight are numbered.
Amy Williams with that report from Monday's Morning Report. And finally, in the Week in Review, a family reunion 100 years in the making. For just over a century, Corporal Willie Snellgrove has been buried at a Porirua cemetery north of Wellington after dying of Spanish flu in December 1918. But his grave has never had a headstone, so his family has never known where he was laid to rest until now. Our defence reporter Jonathan Mitchell takes up the story.
Willie spent most probably about a month just to write up his story and then try and get hold of relatives to make sure they're aware of what we're doing and they approve of what we're doing.
And they do, don't they?
Yes, they do, and that's the little buzz that I get from contacting families and reconnecting them. As you know, often families have no idea, you know.
And in this case, they didn't.
In this case, they didn't. Others do, you know. They're almost my family now because I walk up and down the cemetery quite regularly to look at various pieces, and I know the various corporals and sergeants and who's got military crosses and things around the cemetery.
Quite sad, isn't it? There's just a bit of lawn. There's no plot at all, really.
No. But then, you know, Willie's one of 23 flu victims buried here, and there's a whole row of about 8 or 10 up further where they've got no headstone as well.
Why was that? Why did they bury them without a headstone?
I suppose, look, it's over 100 years ago, so I think they most probably had a simple wooden cross to start with, and over time they have just disappeared, and because family weren't around to maintain the graves, all of us, it's just gone.
How did you know that is where Willie Snellgrove is?
Well, it's quite good because next door to him, or two graves aside, is another flu victim, and so I knew where he was buried, and then I could come tour along to know where Willie's buried.
There'll be a ceremony and there'll be a plaque in a few months' time.
I think we've got to find an appropriate time for him, possibly in August, because that's when he came off Gallipoli. And it's got to fit in with a whole lot of other people, the supply of the headstone, who's around at the time.
That's Alan Dodson speaking with our defence reporter Jonathan Mitchell, as heard on Tuesday's Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki, have a great week.